before we get into talking about afterimage of Empire, I just wanted to quickly ask you about how you got interested in photography from South Asia or India, the subcontinent.
It was actually early on in graduate school. I was in a used bookstore and I saw a book, like a coffee table book. And there was an image in there of skeletons in this courtyard. And all it said in the bottom was Lucknow, and it gave the year the image was taken. So I just got really curious about why there are skeletons arranged in this courtyard and why someone would take a picture of that. That was my hook. And so I started to do research on that. And that's, of course, Beato's famous Skanderbeg photo. In terms of my interest in South Asia, that happens to be in some ways incidental. It's the languages I know better. It's I'm South Asian American, so it was more accessible to me in that way. Mm-hmm. But photography, I never had an interest in before I saw that image.
What is the thinking or the treatment of photography as, say, part of a visual culture treated like in your department today?
Luckily, the department's pretty interdisciplinary. My colleague, Eduardo Cadava, has written a book on photography. The university has a media and modernity track for graduate students. So visual culture is very much considered one of the emerging fields within an English department. So English departments are funny places because film studies also started in English. Mm-hmm. Media studies generally started in English departments. So it has been, as an institutional place, as a place that produces knowledge, it has tended toward the experimental, which is not to say that we don't have our share of faculty who think that this is all nonsense and it doesn't count as literature. But what counts generally for the department, what counts as literature, is really broad. And it started in the 80s, this trend, and it continues.
So let's come back a little bit to that image that you were talking about of Beato's. I was just curious to know your thinking around the idea of the performativity of images and what they did in the 19th century.
I was interested actually in the ambiguity of the image because on the one hand, one of my interests in the image was as a young graduate student, I was coming from this idea that all colonial discourse is necessarily oppressive and photography is a part of colonial forms of knowing, etc. And I realized there was something about the medium of photography that is in excess of those narratives around colonial discourse analysis. So I was interested in how the image is actually ambiguous. On the one hand, it relies on a kind of aesthetic vision of arranging the skeletons in the courtyard just so. And there's something unconscionable about that. On the other hand, it's ambiguous because you could read the image as a critique of war as well.
So coming to the book, can you just talk about how you arrived at the structure of the publication? It seems like it's also maneuvering, apart from timelines, it's maneuvering thematics, ideas generative of the images as such.
Mm-hmm. I think when I started writing this book, I actually had this issue where I needed to figure out what my methodology was. The methodologies that I in the field tended to be either work done by historians or work done by anthropologists. And those methodologies I found very helpful, but they didn't answer all the questions that I felt I had about the images. And those questions had to do with the phenomenology of the image and the relationship of phenomenology to history. Being stationed in an English department where you're kind of encouraged to sort of think outside the box. And I definitely didn't want to give up on the fact that these images are, on the one hand, evidence, but they also disclose something about the world that is not accessible to us without the camera's lens. And I was very interested in how the larger global shift in the 19th century around perception, how that gets imbricated in colonial forms of knowing. So as much as the book is about India, India is a case study for, I'm very interested in how these images are historically conditioned, how phenomenology is in fact related to history. But at the same time, the book is interested in how this is happening globally mm-hmm. in the 19th century too.
So in terms of reference material, certainly there's a kind of focus on Merleau-Ponty. Mm-hmm. There's a reading of, you know, the indexical power of images. So one thinks of Crispini as well in this mm-hmm. regard. I just wanted you to talk a little bit about those points of references that became essential to your debate making within the book.
There's a certain freedom in the fact of its circulation, such that a colonial narrative of an image is not something that can be settled. There's something about the medium itself that unsettles it. Of course it can be used for propaganda. Of course it can be used for the service of the colonial state. It can be very instrumental. But at the same time, as an author, I've been able to read those images against the grain. Mm-hmm. What attracted me to Merleau-Ponty or the phenomenological tradition was that that tradition never lets go of the historical constitution of perception. That perception is something that is socially mediated. We have certain habits of looking and certain habits of seeing, and we tend to see what is familiar to us. And the power of photography is that it provides that and satisfies that. On the other hand, the camera sees more than the photographer intends. There's something always there in the picture that's invisible that might actually be in friction with what we want to see in it. And it's that that interests me. And so Merleau-Ponty, Walter Benjamin, these were folks that were helpful to think with.
One of the things one often thinks about is the universality of the language of photography, whether in fact it is universal. And as your book also then maneuvers, let's say, the famine, Hooper's images somewhat discuss, was there a historical reading as to how these images were perceived at their time as well?
As much as I could dig out those histories of reception, I did my best. And I imagine that there's more stuff that can be dug out. But I will say that I'm not sure that I would agree that perception is universal. In fact, one of the claims that I'm making in the book is that it's not. And one of the ways that I do that is by thinking about why certain genres only become possible under colonialism. Say, for example, ethnographic photographs. And the fact that certain forms of seeing and certain forms of producing knowledge become crystallize at particular historical moments suggests that perception is not universal, that perception is not transhistorical, and it's not universal as well, because this is where photography as a medium, given that it has such an expanded sort of play space, even in the 19th century, soon after it's discovered, what that means is that it's as a medium, it has very fuzzy boundaries. If a photograph published in a newspaper means something slightly different than a photograph on the wall in a museum, for example. Rosalind Krauss wrote this great article in the 70s called Sculpture in an Expanded Field, and someone recently has revised it and talked about photography in an expanded field. And I would revise that and say that the field was already expanded in the 19th century. And insofar as it had been expanded, on the one hand, it's important to think about the photographic medium. On the other hand, it's also, we have to understand that it's actually much similar to something like language, where it gets imbricated with local practices, with local forms of cultural emphases and different forms of cultural accommodation. And there should be nothing surprising about it.
You also referenced the works of Ahmad Ali Khan,
yes,
Daroga Abbas Ali, among others. And Ahmad Ali Khan is kind of credited as being India's first photographer,
right,
allegedly. Deen Dayal appears many, many years later. And Lucknow just incidentally happens to be the center or the focus to some extent, because the mutiny unfolds,
yes,
in this city in an extremely big way. How did one challenge the other in your book?
One of the things that interested me was, well, first I was interested in the form of those early photographs by Khan, where you would get you'd get the photograph painted over, you would get the aristocrat with a halo, etc. That I thought was really interesting in terms of how the photograph was actually in place within the miniature tradition. With Deen Dayal, what interested me was the fact that he has so much invested in this international genre, the picturesque, which he reinvents. And I became curious about why an Indian photographer would be so interested in the picturesque and the discourse on the picturesque that he would have received from the English. And that would be about the English countryside, which, of course, he pushed to its extremes as well. He has an image of a waterfall that's taken, it seems like, right in the center of it. So he pushes the picturesque into the sublime. So on the one hand, you could say that Deen Dayal is wanting to become intelligible in these reigning international genres of photography. On the other hand, the picturesque tradition in England, which was often linked to a certain history around Scottish clearances, around a kind of land grab on the part of the state, and a kind of pretty, making that history pretty through, you know, country gentlemen would want a picturesque image of their country home in that home. That sort of taint, one could say, of the English picturesque isn't quite there in Dean Dalziel. And those were the differences that interested me. That here's a form that allows him to think photographically, but mobilizing the picturesque towards a very different end.